Let us return to hell without delay. All right, the second part of this talk, Hell, a Phenomenological Analysis, part two, the sequel. How can you be happy in heaven if someone you love ends up in hell? Again, a very difficult topic to even think about or try to wrap your mind around. But again, inspired by Pope Benedict, warning us of the real existence of hell and its eternal nature, even if no one talks about it much anymore. And so, always in my own private thinking, from the time I was a child, these two questions recurred to me periodically. Not that I did a lot of heavy thinking as a child, but occasionally, how could hell be compatible with a God of love and mercy? And that was the topic of the first talk. And tried to answer by looking at the inner experience of those lost in evil, and together with looking at the psychic state that might lead a person to long for physical pain as an antidote to emotional or spiritual pain, and try to point toward a solution. But that leaves this other extremely thorny problem, and there are more about hell, of course, but one thorny problem is, how could I ever be happy in heaven and rejoice there if someone I love, perhaps the one I love most in all the world, should end in hell? And here again, Hans Urs von Balthasar, in his book, Dare We Hope That All Men Might Be Saved, he puts his finger on the problem when he writes, quote, "But do the blessed in heaven really rejoice at the punishments of the damned? That would be hate or spite. What then can be said? God, angels, and men can have compassion for sinners as long as they're on earth by wishing to help them find salvation. But St. Thomas says, quote, in the next world, however, their misery can no longer be changed, and thus there can no longer be any proper compassion," unquote. And then von Balthasar goes on, but what about joy over this? Not per se, not direct joy, but still per accidens, secondarily, insofar as the righteous, with a view to divine justice, rejoice at their own liberation, and merely along with this at the torments of the damned. And he quotes that line from St. Thomas from the Commentary on the Sentences, and then he confesses that, although St. Thomas tries to deal with that question, he thinks, more honestly than any other medieval theologian, still von Balthasar calls this, quote, an embarrassing, I would rather say instead, shameful problem to address at all. But he goes on, a problem that can't be avoided if you think in terms of a hell for other people. Quote, for instance, if I were to see from my position in heaven my mother or my best friend undergoing eternal torture, unquote. And he goes on, quote, the point is not to paint a pathetic picture of such situations, but rather to pose the absolutely sober, unavoidable question. Under the aforementioned hypothesis of other people possibly in hell, is every human, every Christian bond designated as a communio sanctorum, a holy community, simply annulled? And more profoundly, as seen from the viewpoint of God himself, does God no longer love the damned, for whom, after all, his Son has died? Now here, of course, von Balthasar raises some extremely important questions, which he doesn't really attempt to directly answer. He rather seems to imply, just by raising the questions the way he does, the one I addressed in the first half as well as this one, he seems to imply that the theological tradition has largely gone astray in implying that large numbers, or at least numbers of others, may be in hell. And he thinks we ought not to think that way at all, but rather focus almost exclusively on the fear that I ought to have for my own soul in relation to hell. Now he's sort of offering that as spiritual advice. You see, it's not healthy to think of other people in hell, it's rather healthy to think of just the possibility of you as an individual. And yet it's hard to see how those two ways of looking at it could be so totally divergent. He implies that the tradition from St. Augustine on ends ultimately in irresolvable antinomies. For example, that those in heaven, transformed in perfect love, nonetheless must have some kind of hate or spite in their souls if they rejoice in the suffering of the damned. And so if that can't be, then something's wrong with the traditional teaching on hell. And that even the God, who is love itself, as well as his elect, no longer love those in hell, even those with whom we as humans have had a close, intimate, personal, loving relationship on earth. So he implies then that the tradition stands in need of radical revision. Now, this merits considerable reflection. Here in response, I would say initially, based on the first part of the first talk, that tragic as it would be for a beloved person to end in hell, we might have some consolation in the knowledge that everything possible has been done by the God of love to save the beloved. And yet the latter, if in hell, has steadfastly, utterly, and for all eternity refused. Now, at first sight, this may seem to be a somewhat thin consolation compared to the force of von Balthasar's statement of the problem, but we shouldn't decide too quickly here. Perhaps we can also know that even while in hell, all that can be done for all eternity to show mercy or mitigate sufferings is being done. As said previously, this involves the consideration that the physical pains of those in hell may actually not be only a justice in relation to sin, but also a mercy in that the physical pains are a distraction from the much more terrible spiritual and emotional pains, in other words, a morbid form of self-help that is allowed. And then I'll skip a page where I review some of the quotes from the books about cutting, from Bright Red Scream and Cutting, Understanding and Overcoming Self-Mutilation and Self-Injury When Pain Feels Good. Since I just read those, you don't need those again. But it's like a parallel to someone who's in terrible emotional distress using physical pain to distract themselves from the emotional distress and thereby looking forward to the physical pain as a relief from the deeper emotional pain. Now in that light then, while St. Thomas may be correct in saying that rejoicing in the suffering of the damned would only be paroxidans, thereby that it means indirect. In other words, what I'm really rejoicing about is that I'm spared what I might have deserved, and I see what I might have deserved among those in hell. And so I don't rejoice directly in their damnation, but indirectly in the fact that I've been saved. This indirect joy might not only be paroxidans or indirect in relation to my being saved, as von Balthasar says, when I see the damned, I'm certainly happy I'm not among them. But you see, von Balthasar says that still smacks to him too much of spite, or there's not enough love there. But in other ways, my rejoicing may be only indirect or paroxidans in relation to the damned. In other words, the blessed certainly do not rejoice in anyone's damnation, nor directly in the suffering that it entails, but in the combination of both the self-imposed justice of the damned soul's state and of its God-given merciful mitigation, the mitigation of the spiritual horrors of despair through the distraction of physical pain. In other words, that the best that can possibly be done to allow the distraction of those in hell is being done. Now then a third indirect point here might also be that the blessed can rejoice in the final restraint of evil forever, so that it can no longer assault the good, that evil is rendered impotent. Now, I would say these latter two motives, and even a proper understanding of the first, cannot be reduced just to spite, as if those in heaven have some spiteful hatred. And so therefore, these indirect attitudes cannot be dismissed simply as incompatible with love and with a God of love. But again, all this may sound a bit too theoretical and roundabout. I mean, in other words, it sort of paints an abstract solution or description of how we might better understand how those in heaven can still rejoice even though there are those in hell and those you may know or love. And so it doesn't seem to address the problem directly enough. What if, as von Balthasar says, my mother or my best friend is damned? How could I be happy in heaven? And so it seems that a more particular or concretely relevant response based in experience with some parallels, perhaps an earthly experience, is needed. And again, though answers here will never be perfect in our present state of affairs, I think we can find some clues pointing toward a solution by looking at concrete human situations we do experience and addressing them phenomenologically and psychologically in terms of our inner experience. The problem has to be addressed on the level of what happens to the beloved, to the person, to the true personality through deep, continued, and perhaps final choices of evil. I submit that what happens ultimately is the self-destruction of the true person, who can only be himself if transformed in truth and goodness through the proper use of his freedom in openness and cooperation with grace. If he instead loses himself in lies and in evil, he progressively loses his true vocation as a person and thus the foundation within him, both for loving and for being loved. Certainly, as we exist in time and with ever the possibility of repentance, there can never come a moment when we would ever be justified in giving up hope in the turnaround, the salvation, the rediscovery, the reappearance, and the reaffirmation of the true self of the beloved. Indeed, given that we do not know with certainty of the damnation of any particular soul, we also can and should continue to hope for the salvation of each individual, as von Balthasar writes. However, if someone is in fact damned, and this would be true at least of the devil and his angels, then that person has shut off, by his own decision, any openness to love. Thus, I would point out that the deeper truth is that if damned, the true self of the beloved person, even your best friend or your mother, really is no more, except as a no longer possible ideal, but not as a real potential anymore. He or she has undergone, through his own choices of evil, the complete eradication of anything that was good and true qualitatively in his or her personality. The genuine person has been completely replaced by an evil caricature and is no more. For example, on a popular level, this was on a rerun a few weeks ago, this is sometimes the stuff of fantasy or science fiction, as in an episode of the old TV show Star Trek, where Captain Kirk once went through a space warp or some odd thing and was replaced by a totally evil twin. Except that in real life, it's not funny and entertaining, you see. Or again, for example, in the Star Wars saga, when Obi-Wan Kenobi explains why he told Luke that Darth Vader murdered Anakin Skywalker, quote, "Your father was seduced by the dark side. He ceased to be Anakin Skywalker and became Darth Vader. When that happened, the good man who was your father was destroyed," unquote. Or again, the great sage Yoda says earlier to Obi-Wan, quote, "Twisted by the dark side, young Skywalker has become. The boy you trained, gone he is, consumed by Darth Vader," unquote. Or later in episode 3, when Padme, his wife, says to Anakin, quote, "I don't believe what I'm hearing. You've changed. I don't know you anymore because of what you've done," unquote. Now, granted that in Star Trek, the good Kirk comes back to overcome the evil Kirk, and in Star Wars, Darth Vader eventually repents in light of the faithful love of his son. You were right, Luke. But what if such metanoia is in fact no longer possible? What if someone is eternally hardened in evil? Then we have only the corrupted remainder of what was meant to be the beloved. But without any further foundation for love, other than the being's original nature and powers, which have been corrupted, but the original nature and powers provide the reason for a continued affirmation in existence. But that original nature and powers, especially the mind and the will, have now been used to reject all truth, goodness, and beauty, both within and without. This is why in Perelandra, C.S. Lewis refers to the possessed Weston as the unman, the opposite of all that man and all that this particular man should be and was meant to be. And one quote from Perelandra, "And he chilled with the inarticulate night nursery horror of the thing he had to deal with, the man-aged corpse, the bogey, the unman." This again is why the psychologist M. Scott Peck, in his book People of the Lie, his experientially based study of evil, quotes his 9-year-old son as pointing out that evil, E-V-I-L, is the exact opposite of live, L-I-V-E. Father Gerald Vann, in his book The Pain of Christ and the Sorrow of God, has described this state of rebellion against life and love more deeply and chillingly as follows, quote, "There can be a state of soul against which love itself is powerless because it has hardened itself against love. Hell is essentially a state of being which we fashion for ourselves, a state of final separateness from God, which is the result not of God's repudiation of man, but of man's repudiation of God, and a repudiation which is eternal precisely because it has become in itself immovable. There are analogies in human experience. The hate which is so blind, so dark, that love only makes it more violent. The pride which is so stony that humility only makes it more scornful. The inertia, last but not least the inertia, which has so taken possession of the personality that no crisis, no appeal, no inducement whatsoever can stir it into activity, but on the contrary makes it bury itself the more deeply in its immobility. So with the soul and God, pride can become hardened into hell. Hatred can become hardened into hell. Any of the 7 root forms of wrongdoing can harden into hell, and not least that sloth, which is boredom with divine things, the inertia that cannot be troubled to repent, even though it sees the abyss into which the soul is falling, because for so long, in little ways perhaps, it has accustomed itself to refuse whatever might cost it an effort." Unquote. Thus, in our freedom, we're capable of destroying ourselves as positive personalities, of being our own assassins as far as anything qualitatively good remaining in us. This is the second death our Lord warns us to fear. Theoretically, this is hard to envision, since we never experience it completely here on earth. But at the moment of eternal insight, we will know and experience that the God of love has truly loved the beloved person in our lives even more than we ever did, that he has done all he could to save the true self of the beloved, and that what is left of the beloved after final rejection of God and goodness is no longer truly the beloved. At this point, we must accept that the possibility of a full love relationship, which is a back and forth relationship, is over. Thus, it becomes necessary to discuss, at least briefly, to what extent those in hell may continue to be the object of love, and then to reflect on how this relates to happiness. Love can be approached here under several aspects. First, under the aspect of love as a value response. The beloved can continue to be affirmed in his or her fundamental being and accompanying powers, in this case of the person, especially the mind and the will and the heart. But for the person in hell, there can still be a fundamental affirmation in love of the goodness of the created person of a human nature, and of the gift of his fundamental powers, prescinding from how he has used them. So there can still be an affirmation of the goodness of the original creation of any person with the powers of a person. Furthermore, two fundamental accompanying attitudes characteristic of or filling out the essence of love include the intentio benevolentiae, the intention of goodness toward the other, and the intentio unionis, the intention of union with the beloved. That is, when you love someone, you naturally want what is good and fulfilling for the other, his happiness. And you naturally want what will bring true unity with the beloved. Of course, in light of Revelation, we also discover that the fulfillment of these two essential dimensions of love can only occur in unity with the infinite resounding I love you of the Most Holy Trinity. So true goodness for the other and true union with the other can ultimately only happen with God and in God, who is our Creator and Savior and Restorer. But how can one have an intentio benevolentiae and an intentio unionis in reference to the damned? Well, first, regarding the intentio benevolentiae, I think all that we can hope for in intending the goodness of the other here is that if the other has insisted on damnation for themselves, the best possible result for the damned will be some mitigation of their despair and spiritual misery, since they themselves reject any possible genuine good. In this respect, the best that can be done in love for the damned is to allow the mitigation and distraction of the spiritual pain through the physical pain, as discussed in the previous paper, and that this is a type of mercy for the damned as well as a type of justice. And I think that's the best that the intention of goodness in love can do if the beloved refuses to be loved truly. The best we can hope for is to make the other's circumstances the best one can from outside, since anything deeper or more genuine is rejected. Now, even more seriously, in reference to those in hell, and this is where the problem becomes more acute, it becomes apparent concerning the intention of union in love, that the only way to be with the beloved in union, if we're dealing with someone who is damned, would really to be to agree to a pseudo-union. We would have to, in other words, go over completely to the other person's lie. But this could be done only by rejecting every other good, including God and one's own true self, and every other beloved person, and even the true self of the beloved. In other words, I must become one of the people of the lie myself if I wish to join the beloved in evil. And I can only join the beloved on his or her terms if they have insisted on their own self-damnation. I would have to completely agree with the beloved's lie and allow myself to be completely taken over by the beloved. But that does not lead to any true unity with the beloved. That's what happens in possession, in being possessed, not in loving union. Now again, M. Scott Peck illustrates this in the case study that he does of a client of his that he calls Charlene, who continues in therapy for many years without success, without any progress. And this mystifies him, since he usually finds that those most deeply in evil flee from therapy, as they flee from any change. They want to cling to their lie. So they're the ones that won't come to therapy. They don't want to talk about their own lives at all. So why does she keep coming back for many years of therapy? And he finally realizes that she's been coming back, I think it's about 9 years. She does so only in order to seduce him, her therapist, to have him, to have a relationship with him, but only on her own terms, of conquest and selfishness. Now, she expresses her desire in terms of loving him. But, he says, this is part of the narcissistic lie she lives in, and with complete stubbornness and willful resistance refuses to let go of. Now, this finally comes out, all of this, in their last session. She never returns after this exchange, where he raises some ultimate questions. Quote, "When I asked Charlene why she wanted sex with me, her answer was perfectly simple, because I love you. Although I repeatedly raised the issue of its genuineness, to Charlene the reality of her love, quote unquote, was unquestionable. My own experience of her love, however, was that it invariably excluded the reality of me. As far as she was concerned, my feelings did not really exist. This is narcissism in its ultimate form. For the complete narcissist, others have no more psychologic reality than a piece of furniture. Narcissists have what Martin Buber calls an I-it relationship." Peck then speaks to her of God. He raises ultimate questions. He challenges her with the idea of God and that the purpose of life is ultimately to glorify Him. Her response was as follows. There was a short silence. For a brief moment, I thought she might cry, the one time in our work together. Then she said, "I cannot do it. There's no room for me in that. That would be my death," she said in a quavering voice. Then, with a suddenness that frightened me, what seemed to be her choked back sobs turned into a roar. "I don't want to live for God. I will not. I want to live for me, for my sake, my own sake." It was another session in the middle of which Charlene walked out. I felt a terrible pity for her. I wanted to cry, but my own tears would not come. "Oh God, she's so alone," was all I could whisper. Eventually, Peck concludes with the following summation. Charlene's desire to make a conquest of me, to toy with me, to utterly control our relationship knew no bounds. It seemed to be a desire for power purely for its own sake. She did not want power in order to improve society or care for a family or make herself a more effective person or in any way accomplish anything creative. Her thirst for power was unsubordinated to anything higher than itself. Unquote. As we can see here, those lost in evil will have us only on their own terms. And if we were to join them, we would have to give up all else, including God Himself and our own true good, and give ourselves over to the lie of the other and to our own lie in order to, quote unquote, love them, that is, really be possessed by them on their own terms. We must ultimately join the father of lies if we're to continue in fractured and mutually destructive relationship with the formerly beloved. As Peck describes Charlene, quote, "A key element in her behavior was her request, no, her demand, that I affirm her not just for who she might become, but for who she was, sickness and all. If for no other reason, her demand was impossible to fulfill because it was a demand to affirm her sickness." In Martin Buber's words, the evil insist upon, quote, "affirmation independent of all findings," unquote. There's simply no way to fully love them any longer because of what they've done to themselves. The true self of the beloved has been rejected by the beloved himself. If in hell, it no longer exists and thus cannot be loved as a real or any longer even as a potential way of their being. Darth Vader in the storyline had time to repent and turn around. Those in hell no longer do. We cannot imagine what the beloved would look like without any remaining beauty or goodness as a complete evil caricature, because we never experience such a thing in this life. Thus, we cannot imagine not loving and wanting to continue to be with the beloved. This is not something we can explain very well, speculatively or theoretically, but can only be understood at the moment of seeing and experiencing. However, again, as a clue or a help here, such an experience, or at least a parallel, is described rather well in Bram Stoker's Dracula. When the beloved Lucy comes back as a corrupt and evil vampire, and the hero, Professor Van Helsing, must destroy her. And the real Van Helsing in the book has no relation to the silly movie of the name Van Helsing a few years ago. Van Helsing is in fact a Catholic from the continent who comes to help the people in England, and in the midst of the crisis goes back to the continent, and you don't know why, because it's in the midst of the crisis about Lucy. But he goes back to get permission from his bishop to bring this consecrated host, which he then uses to combat Dracula. It's a very Catholic book in its own way, but also with various science fiction dimensions, of course. Now the question is, how can such an act of destruction, you know, now that Lucy is supposedly one of the evil undead, and Van Helsing knows he has to destroy her, but how can such an act of destruction be explained to her fiancé, Arthur, who only remembers her as the way she was? And if she's still alive, even in some weird state, how can you explain that she needs to be totally destroyed, you see? How can Van Helsing ever convey to Arthur the necessity of a second death for his beloved Lucy, of removing her from this world of the living, if Arthur ever learns that she's still in some way alive? Now, Van Helsing decides there's no way he can adequately explain it in words. He can't explain it theoretically to the young man. So instead, he insists that the loving fiancé accompany him to the graveyard to see for himself. Lucy has been locked out of the grave, to which she must return by daybreak, and she's been locked out by Van Helsing making a paste of the sacred host and plugging it into all the cracks so she can't get through. And as I say, he somehow received special permission for this from his bishop. But anyway, Lucy, one of the undead by now, comes back toward the grave carrying a child, a baby whose blood she has just drunk, full of the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh and the pride of life. At seeing this evil caricature of the girl he loved, her fiancé Arthur in the end acquiesces to her second death in a way that never could have been explained to him and which he would never have agreed to on theoretical grounds alone. Here's the description told from the perspective of his friend Jonathan. The white figure was now near enough for us to see clearly, and the moonlight still held. My own heart grew cold as ice, and I could hear the gasp of Arthur as we recognized the features of Lucy. Lucy, but yet how changed! The sweetness was turned to adamantine, heartless cruelty, and the purity to voluptuous wantonness. We could see that the lips were crimson with fresh blood, and the stream had trickled over her chin. When Lucy, I call the thing that was before us Lucy because it bore her shape, saw us, she drew back with an angry snarl, such as a cat gives when taken unawares. Then her eyes ranged over us. Lucy's eyes in form and color, but Lucy's eyes unclean and full of hellfire instead of the pure green, gentle orbs we knew. At that moment, the remnant of my love passed into hate and loathing. Had she then to be killed, I could have done it. As she looked, her eyes blazed with an unholy light, and the face became wreathed with a voluptuous smile. Oh God, how it made me shudder to see it. With a careless motion, she flung to the ground, callous as a devil, the child that up to now she had clutched strenuously to her breast, growling over it as a dog growls over a bone. There was a cold-bloodedness in the act which wrung a groan from Arthur. When she advanced to him with outstretched arms and a wanton smile, he fell back and hid his face in his hands. Still she advanced, however, and with a languorous, voluptuous grace said, Come to me, Arthur, leave these others and come to me. My arms are hungry for you. Come and we can rest together. Come, my husband, come. There was something diabolically sweet in her tones. However, Von Helsing then traps her between a crucifix and the sacred host, barring her way back into the tomb, and she changes. The description goes on. Never did I see such baffled malice on a face, and never, I trust, shall such ever be seen again by mortal eyes. The beautiful color became livid. The eyes seemed to throw out sparks of hellfire. The brows were wrinkled as though the folds of the flesh were the coils of Medusa's snakes. And the lovely, blood-stained mouth grew to an open square as in the passion masks of the Greeks and Japanese. If ever a face meant death, if looks could kill, we saw it at that moment. Van Helsing broke the silence by asking Arthur, "Answer me, O my friend, am I to proceed in my work?" Arthur threw himself on his knees and hid his face in his hands as he answered, "Do as you will, friend, do as you will. There can be no horror like this ever anymore." Unquote. Hence again, the only union, quote unquote, possible with an evil one involves becoming evil oneself. Union only on the other's terms of pride and concupiscence, a union of lies. But the true lover sees that such a thing is completely impossible, and that it would involve a complete betrayal of the original genuine love. Thus, in the fantasies mentioned, for Padme to join Anakin as he becomes Darth Vader, or for Arthur to join Lucy, or in reality, for us to join Satan or any of his minions, including someone we have originally loved, is to betray oneself, to betray one's genuine love of the other, and in fact, it's to acquiesce in the betrayal of the beloved, in what the beloved has done to himself. To acquiesce indeed in the rejection and betrayal of all that is good and true and beautiful, to acquiesce in the betrayal of God. Impossible for a true lover. Although hard to theoretically explain, such examples, allowing some experiential contact, may help to give us some sense of how these things can be. Finally, it's important for us to recognize how much we all do tend to live in our own private fantasy world and refuse to be transparent before God. How often we tend to fit Him into our plans and only accept Him on our terms, rather than with a proper receptivity and honesty and readiness to change. In other words, we all have this danger of a tendency toward narcissistic personality disorder or toward using others, as Wojtyła described in comparing love and using in Love and Responsibility, or toward what Gabriel Marcel calls a lack of disponibilité, by which he means availability to others in love. And so Marcel compares what he calls egolatry, self-idolatry, to true openness and receptivity and welcoming. Or again, toward a refusal of a humble and reverent response to value compared to the mere pursuit of self-gratification in von Hildebrand's value terms. Or toward a ludicrous refusal to genuinely pursue even our own true happiness and fulfillment because we prefer our own erroneous vision and prideful will, to use terms from Joseph Pieper interpreting St. Thomas. The rejection of these positive attitudes can extend even toward God, and such rejections of reason, goodness, being, truth, beauty, and the willingness to open and give ourselves as a gift in response, as Wojtyła stresses, are the antecedents of hell. And yet we're very comfortable in their precincts, though they make us appear not only as selfish and prideful, but ultimately as silly buffoons before God and his angels. They constitute a major step toward isolation and misery, toward self-paralysis and impotent revolt against being, toward digging our own grave in the second death of hell. Thus, in conclusion, what might the attitude toward the damned of those in heaven be? Beyond affirmation of the goodness of the original being and the original powers of the persons there who have ruined themselves, I think there can be only pity, together with a paroxysm's joy at our own redemption from such a fate, again, an indirect joy at the mysterious unity of mercy and justice in the state of the damned, and an indirect joy in the final restraint of evil. We will see then that God in his love has done all he can for the damned, allowing them to build a physical hell for themselves as a diversion from their deeper spiritual despair. We will see that they, in their narcissism and pride, have insisted on their present state and refused to leave it, and that we, who might have done more for them in our lifetime, have mercifully been forgiven by God, as we must forgive ourselves. And there we must leave it, in acceptance that further relationship here is impossible. I end with two quotes from M. Scott Peck. Quote, "The evil are pathologically attached to the status quo of their personalities, which in their narcissism they consciously regard as perfect. I think it is quite possible that the evil may perceive even a small degree of change in their beloved selves as representing total annihilation." And finally, quote, "God does not punish us, we punish ourselves. Those who are in hell are there by their own choice. Indeed, they could walk right out of it if they so chose, except that their values are such as to make the way out of hell appear overwhelmingly dangerous, frighteningly painful, and impossibly difficult. So they remain in hell because it seems safe and easy to them. They prefer it that way. This situation and the psychodynamics involved here were the subject of C.S. Lewis' fine book, The Great Divorce. The notion that people are in hell by their own choice is not widely familiar, but the fact is that it is both good psychology and good theology." Unquote. In the end, we must respect the choice which the beloved eternally insists upon. The end. Thank you.